From petitioner in the case of McClendon versus Ingersoll Rand Company.
May I please report, Mr. Michael Saunders and Mr. John Aberhan will present the evidence for petitioner. Mr. Aberhan, please.
Thank you. May it please this honorable court and counsel. Harry McClendon worked for Ingersoll Rand for over 9.5 years. He gave a lot of his time and work to the company. He had a successful sales job in San Antonio with an established commission base. He was in the management and sale of construction business. He had a good base there. The employer came to him and said, Perry, we want you to go to Dallas. There's a potential new market there. You're a good salesperson. We want you to go and try and start a new market. He, trusting his employer, gets up, leaves his established commission base, moves to San Antonio with his family, starts a new market, gets a big account for them, and just as he's about to vest in his pension, just as he's about to score a fairly big commission, they look at Perry and say, well, thanks for opening the new market for us, but now you're fired. Perry McClendon has no negotiating power. He's there in a different city, luckily not too far away from his home, but in a different city, stuck without a job and no job security. What about Stephen Little? He was the plaintiff in the Little versus Bryce case, which is a Houston Court of Appeals case. He was employed by Randall's, and Randall said he was a perfect employee, had done nothing wrong for 3 years. A co-employee tells a supervisor that Mr. Little or the person he was living with either had AIDS or was being tested for AIDS. Randall summarily discharges this man. No more job, no more job security. What about the man or woman in today's environment that is a whistleblower, that blows a whistle or reports a bad act, an unethical act, an impropriety to management of a company? And that act doesn't amount to the refusal to commit a crime. But that person, the man or woman, blows a whistle and says, look, this is unethical conduct. This is what these people in this company are doing. They report that. All of a sudden, that person gets fired. Without some kind of duty of good faith and fair dealing on an employer, these people will go without redress. They will have no right of action. And why? Because we're relying on a 101-year-old doctrine that has been mischaracterized through the years as employment at will.
Counsel, let me at the offset ask you why, since the retirement has vested in this case, why is it not that you're asking us to give you an advisory opinion?
Your Honor, we're not only asking for the retirement benefits. In fact, the retirement was paid before the summary judgment in this case.
So that moots that issue?
Well, the retirement issue does not moot the issue of losing your job. You see, by depriving someone of the retirement, yes, you're doing that, and that's one wrong that needs to be right. But you've also lost your job because the employer didn't want to pay you your retirement. You see, so you've lost your retirement, and you want to get that, but you've also lost a 10-year job or a 20-year or 30-year job. So there are more wrongs here than just the retirement.
And then there's a question then remains whether or not you had any rights in the beginning.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And whether or not you could have walked away from the job or whether or not they could have fired you without any explanation.
That's right.
Counsel, assume that there was a contract and the date here is December 31st, 1982.
Yes, sir.
Is it your position that on January 1, 1983, the company could have fired him at will?
Well, Your Honor, that's not my position. I mean,
it's your position that the only way they could fire him at any time after January 1, 1983 is for good cause.
Judge, I don't think that's even my position. I think there's a continuum, and it's a little hard to explain, but I'd like to try. At some point in time, because of either what is said, that would depend. If they said to him, come from this job that you have, because we need a 5-year employee, and we want you to do that, then because of that fact, yes, I think there's an implied duty of good faith as of the first day of employment.
If he moves to another city and starts a new market, and one of the competitors says, I love what you're doing, would you go to work for me? And he goes to work for the competitor. Would his employer then have a cause of action against the employee?
I believe the duty would work both ways, and it should work both ways. I have no problem with that, but because it needs to apply in the workplace.
What is the basis of that duty? Where do we get that duty?
We get the duty from a special relationship. And I think the law in Texas has already developed to the point, and I think the crystal question today, and there are lots of questions, and it's a fascinating issue, but the crystal question is, does the employment situation create a special relationship, special enough to impose a special duty, a special tort duty of good faith and fair dealing? And where do we have that in Texas? Most recently, we have it in the insurance context. We started with the Arnold case, and then Aranda was a little different because it was a statutory scheme, but we extended it there. Where did we have it before the insurance context? We have it with partners, joint venturers, agents, and principals. They have a special duty. Why? Because you have to look at the relationship. A typical contractual relationship is for economic gain or profit. An insurance contract, this court has held, is different from that. Why is it different? Because of the positions of the people, because of the unequal bargaining power, and because of the chance that an unscrupulous insurer will use that bargaining power against the insured. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You refer on page 36 to when the doctrine that you're advocating today should be applied, and you mentioned that whenever there's unequal bargaining power or superior bargaining power. Are you saying that this special relationship exists whenever there is superior bargaining power?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying it exists in the employment setting because there's superior bargaining power.
Is there not superior bargaining power in every employee-employer relationship?
Yes, sir, I do. That's why I think it applies in all employment settings.
Even with the mom-and-pop store that's just trying to get a clerk?
Just, that's a harder question. And I think...
Why I asked?
No, and I think there might be a very fair way to do that and make a cutoff of 10-person employees or 15-person employees or even 25.
You're asking us to make some policy decisions to carve out and draw some lines. Are these matters left better for the legislature than us?
Judge, that argument's been made for years and no inroads have been made. I think in Sabine Pilot, this honorable court did carve out such an exception.
But there we have an illegal act. It was clearly a problem.
Well, but see, there are lots of problems that go all the way up to illegal acts, Your Honor. What if somebody said, I'm not going to make my men and women do that because it's an unsafe act? Well, if you're not going to let them do that, you're fired. There's no protection right now under that. That person can get fired at will. And that's the point. And this honorable court has done it and can do it. And you go back to that duty. Judge, it's not only the superior bargaining power, because an employment setting is so much more. We look at our employment as our self-worth, our dignity in today's society. It's not just for economics. It's to put food on our tables. It's to send our kids to school. It's to get medical benefits. It's to get retirement benefits. It's not a typical contract.
Let me ask you, on page 19 of your brief, you say it should be judicially modified in an effort to conform to the realities of today's employment.
Yes, sir.
In one of the amicus briefs, have you read the amicus
brief
filed by Hughes and Luce?
Yes, sir, I have.
And you're saying, okay, we've got to conform to the realities of today's employment. And they're saying, our client, Texas Instruments, has 75,000 people. We're having to compete with Koreans, the Japanese, Taiwanese. They're not handicapped by this sort of arrangement. We have to build plants, close plants, let people go based upon a world economy in which this country is falling behind. How do you reconcile those two conflicting policy decisions?
I don't think they're all that conflicting, Your Honor. And the reason is this. All insurance companies and all employers don't always deny claims and don't always fire people. Texas Instruments has a good record. They didn't put their statistics of how many times they've been sued or what kind of judgments they've gone out. This is not, if insurance companies or employers, and I lump them together just because we do have some law already on the insurance company. If the insurance companies always deny claims, as a general rule, they wouldn't be in business because it's not only individuals buying insurance companies, they're companies and businesses. If an employer always fired its people, they wouldn't be in business at all. This doctrine is to go to those abuses, those arbitrary, malicious abuses that shouldn't happen. It's very broad in a way, but it's very narrow at the same time.
On page 26 of your brief, you say he was terminated due to a subjective rating scale. Are you saying that for an employer to terminate an employee, it must be an objective system?
There should be some kind of objective criteria. He should be treated with good faith and fair dealing. If an employee, yes. So the answer to your question is yes, there needs to be some reason for that employee to be terminated.
You referred in your brief to the Uniform Commercial Code section 1203, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I have read that section and the commentary that goes with it. And the commentary under the UCC also refers you to 1205. And 1205 modifies 1203, and 1205 deals with courses of dealing and usages of the trade. Now, the course of dealing in Texas has always been that most employment contracts, unless otherwise provided, were terminable at will. Is that not correct?
Well, you can call it a course of dealing, or you can call it a policy, Judge. I think it's really the fire at will doctrine has been ingrained. That doesn't, and many people have tried to get rights for these employees. I don't really know if it's a question of course of dealing or something that's been imposed. I don't know if that's a fair distinction, but.
Well, under 1102, which is the purposes and rules of construction of the Uniform Commercial Code, it says, shall be liberally construed to promote its underlying purposes, one of which is to permit the continued expansion of commercial practices through custom usage and agreement of the parties. Is there a custom or usage in this state that it has been terminable at will?
Well, yes, but there was a custom of slavery at one point, too.
But that was repealed by the Emancipation Proclamation.
But isn't there an analogy, Your Honor? What you're saying is, has the employment relationship and what employment means to each man and woman in Texas today, not in Korea or somebody else, has that changed in the last 101 years since the East Line decision? And yes, that policy, the court came down with that policy, and it's been the same. But has our, you're right, it's been a custom because it's been a policy from the court, but hasn't the reason changed? Isn't the employment, our employment today, so much different? Doesn't it include so many more things than employment included back in 1888? I think it does.
Since 1888, has there not been well over several dozen statutes passed to protect employees?
There have been statutes passed to protect employees in certain classes, not all employees.
Well, race, color, sex, age.
What about white males under 40? No protection. Does that mean employers can just draw a line and say, well, if they're almost going to vest, or if they're almost going to start getting the real fruits of retirement, because remember, retirement benefits get better as we stay at one place longer. And employers say, their brief says, well, ERISA is going to preempt all that. ERISA might redress the wrong for not paying that retirement up to them, but it doesn't redress the wrong for firing someone. A person that's worked for 25 years in a factory and then gets canned, if that person worked another 10 years, they could probably retire and not worry about anything. But those are the kinds of things that have changed, Your Honor, and I think that's why we need a change in our law.
But to be sure I understand, you think that if the employee works for 25 years and then decides to leave on his own, there might be an action against him for breach of good faith and fair dealing?
I believe that's right, Your Honor, and I believe if you're going to extend it, it would go both ways in the employment setting.
Isn't that Hill versus Auto Trim.
Yeah. Hill versus and the Boatman
Hill
case.
And Norris versus Bergman, among others.
Well, Your Honor, I just feel if you're going to impose the duty on one side, the duty would go to both. That's what I believe.
We don't have any duty except contractual on an insurance policyholder to deal in good faith and fair dealing with the company.
I'm sorry?
The duties you're using as an analogy generally have run one way. and not both ways. Now, partner, partner, joint venture, joint venture are one thing, but then we're talking about a fiduciary and fiduciary and a trustee. That's a one-way duty.
Well, Your Honor, it's a matter of my belief. It needs to go both ways if you're going to protect it. I mean, that's part of why companies are buying, why individuals are buying into companies now, because we're looking more, I think, towards long-term employment, be part of the business, part of my company. And that's just what I think if you're going to apply.
But is this the change you're referring about since 1888? I mean, is that what you had in mind?
No, Your Honor.
Less mobile than they were then?
No, not only less mobile, it's just the employment now is really a package of survival. It's retirement benefits. It's medical benefits. Medical benefits as an example. If we use the analogy again from the insurance industry, if an employee is terminated, usually many employers give a medical package with that, a medical benefit package. If that employee is terminated, just look at the medical. What happens to that employee and his or her family if all of a sudden the medical benefits are gone? It's just like getting an insurance contract terminated, saying, well, we're cutting off your benefits. That's it. You don't have a job anymore and that benefit is gone. Yes, there's federal legislation that says, well, the employer now has a duty to allow or permit that employee at his or her own expense to continue that employee, that insurance benefit. But if the employee can't afford that, it's gone. Isn't it just like, just on that one point, the same thing on an insurance contract?
That's only for 24 months anyway, I believe.
That's a perfect example. Under COBRA, I think it's 2 years. That's right. And then the person has to go out and try and find their own benefits. So, Judge, that's what I'm saying is different. Plus, it is a lot more mobile. You have to move with a company if a company asks you to move. And once you have 5 or 6 years vested in a company, or 10 or 15 years vested, and they say, well, we want you to go to San Francisco, it's real hard. You know, you have all these other benefits. Medical, pension benefits are adding up, time off, better vacation, everything is adding up. And it's so much harder now to say, well, I'll just walk down the street and I'll go get a job in another factory. It's just, so I think much more has changed in addition to the mobility.
But let me ask you, because of the downturn in the economy in Texas starting in approximately 1982, a lot of law firms that once had flourishing corporate, bond, real estate practices had lawyers who had no work. Okay, would the law firms be required to retrain their lawyers? Or would that be sufficient cause to let them go?
That would, again, you're asking, it's a fact question, but if there's a reason. Everything's scare tactics. You know, people seem to be saying, well, this can't happen, this is going to happen. What you're saying is, worst case, 12 people are going to decide if that employer treated that employee fair.
So if the lawyer who was let go because he no longer had a real estate practice, the jury would determine whether or not the law firm had an obligation to retrain him in bankruptcy or something else.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right, Your Honor. And all the facts would be taken into consideration.
Would not be flooded? Every employment case would be a jury trial or fact determination. There'd be no rule of reason. It'd be a fact-based, no policy, just fact-based, and be different in every situation.
Well, it would be different in every situation. I know I read one of the briefs in the Arnold case, Judge, and I think the same exact argument was made, that every insurance policy that was ever denied to some extent would have a litigant coming into the court. And I say, I take my hat off, and I ask from all the people that you've talked to and all the lawyers, what has happened since Arnold? There have been some big judgments in the insurance industry, but you know what else has happened? Insurance companies are taking a lot closer look at denying claims unfairly. And talk to your lawyers on the plaintiff side and defense side. That's what they say. That's the way it should be. You see, because those insurers could only say, and this is the way it was. We could deny the claim. Maybe the person will be intimidated. Maybe it's a $5,000 claim. No lawyer will ever take it. And if they come back and they sue us, the worst we're going to have, until you change the law, the worst that's going to happen, we'll pay the policy and a little bit of interest. So we'll keep it in our pocket. That's the way the employment setting is now, only it's even worse. They don't even have, in many cases, except where retirement is deprived, they don't even have that downside of having to pay the retirement.
Counsel, you
could contract for termination only on good cause.
Yes, sir. You still can do that.
Why doesn't that solve the problem?
Because the employee usually, I think maybe Akeem Olajuwon and Nolan Ryan can, but most employees don't have that flexibility, and it goes back to the unequal bargaining power. The typical employee at very high levels, not only the labor, but at fairly high levels, the typical employee that cannot come in and say, Mr. XYZ employer, I'll come work for you, only if we have a termination for good cause in there. Employers will not do that, and you have to ask yourself, what are they so afraid of?
You've made a lot of statements about changes in the last 100 years, the marketplace, perhaps these things are relevant to the court in carving out a decision. Can you file any Brandeis-type brief or give us any suggestions of where to go, to what kind of studies have been made that would enlighten us about the true facts and economic conditions of employment as opposed to just a sense that things were one way in 1888?
Your Honor, I can't report any of that to you today. I can report potential clients that come into my office and give situations.
That's hardly a sufficient basis for making a policy decision with profound implications to the entire state.
Well,
I mean, our sense of what we've heard from lawyers in a different type of case, or your sense of what you hear from clients.
Well, Your Honor, it comes down to, again, is this a special enough relationship to imply that duty? And I think just from the realities of today's employment setting, I think that there's enough there to make it a special relationship to imply a duty of good faith and fair dealing on the employee.
How many states have a tort duty of good faith and fair dealing in employment contracts?
Only two right now, Your Honor. Montana and Nevada. I think about four or five others had it and limited to contractual damages. And California, the Supreme Court in Foley just gave an opinion that cited in the amicus briefs. When we filed our brief, that wasn't out. And I'd like to use my last couple of minutes just to mention the Foley case. I think Judge Broussard wrote an incredibly great dissent. That was a very close decision in California, and it was 4-3. And I just want to read just a little section because he tried to compare it to the insurance setting. And he said, if we must argue analogies, the question is not whether the employment contract differs from the insurance contract in one particular respect or resembles a commercial contract in another. It is whether, as a whole, the contract of employment more closely resembles an insurance contract or an ordinary commercial contract. The answer is clear. The principal reason we permit tort damages for breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing in an insurance contract is that persons do not generally purchase insurance to obtain a commercial advantage, but to secure the peace of mind and security it will provide in protecting against accidental loss. That reason applies equally to the employer-employee relationship. A man or a woman usually does not enter into employment solely for the money. A job is status, reputation, a way of defining one's self-worth, and a worth in the community. It is also essential to financial security, offering assurance of future income needed to repay present debts and meet future obligations. Without a secure job, a worker frequently cannot obtain a retirement pension and often lacks access to affordable medical insurance. In short, in a modern industrialized economy, employment is central to one's existence and dignity. And the majority court came back and they said, well, we're still going to imply this duty of good faith and fair dealing, but we're going to limit the damages to contractual damages. I urge this court, if you're willing to adopt the duty, not to limit those damages. Even though the Supreme Court in California said the statute of frauds would not apply to the contractual damages, they did not take into effect the problem that employees have. If you only limit it to contractual damages, you will put employers in the same position that they're in, and they could sit there and say, well, here's our downside. This is our liability. If we fire them, the most we're going to have to pay is this. And as many of the dissents in Foley says, what you need to do to protect and to make that duty effective is to make employers realize that they'll be liable for tort damages, because no one knows until you see someone in your family close to you lose a job after they've worked for a long time, what a devastating effect that could have, especially on people that have worked for 15 or 20 years in the same job. And when that happens, that wrong cannot be righted by just contractual damages. And that's why I believe the duty should be imposed and tort damages should be imposed in connection with the duty. I thank you all very much.
The court is ready to hear arguments from Ms. Collins.
May I place the court, Mr. William Little, Mr. Philip Fivego, to present arguments to respondent, Mr. Little Boy.
May it please the court, counsel. Harry McClendon is trying very hard to convince you all that this is a special case that deserves special treatment, that special treatment being the reversal of more than a century of judicial precedent in the state. But despite the efforts that he has made in his briefs and despite the efforts he has made in his arguments here today, I think the case is different than that. This is not a special case. This is a case which involves ordinary, unremarkable, and commonplace facts. And here they are. They're in the record. Mr. McClendon sold construction equipment. He was paid a salary. He received a commission on the products he sold. And on November 19th of 1982, he was laid off as part of a company-wide reduction in force. The court has already alluded to the fact that a serious recession gripped the state of Texas about that time, and Ingersoll Rand wound up losing 10,000 employees in the next 2.5 years. In connection with being laid off, he was paid his severance pay and all the commissions he had coming to them. He found comparable work in a field for which he was trained and experienced and for which he had an interest and an inclination within 2.5 months.
Is the loss of 10,000 employees in the record?
No, Your Honor, it's not. I allude to the fact merely to suggest that the drastic economic consequences which gripped the state of Texas at that time gripped the entire nation. The facts in that regard were not developed in this record.
Was there anyone else from his office who was laid off?
Yes, Your Honor. There are names mentioned in depositions that were taken in this case of people who were laid off, people who assumed double responsibility to conduct sales in the region that he was responsible for. I think there's a point made in his brief that Mr. McClendon objects to the fact that his job was really not done away with but filled with someone else, when the facts that were developed in the trial court prior to the summary judgment proceedings suggest quite clearly that people doubled up and assumed additional requirements as part of this company-wide reduction in force.
So no one new was hired to take this place?
That's the position of Ingersoll Rand, Your Honor. Yes, it is.
These other people that were fired or let go, were their retirement about to vest also?
There's no evidence developed in this case, Your Honor, that would allow me to answer that question. But Justice Gonzalez, you raised the point earlier as to whether or not this case involves a request for an advisory opinion. It's clear from the plaintiff's petitioner's second amended petition that there's no dispute here that these pension benefits he was talking about were vested. And the evidence developed in the trial court clearly suggests that this whole concern about those pension benefits is misdirected. There was no inquiry ever made by Mr. McClendon on that point, and no information was ever given to him on that point. He just assumed that when he left, he would have no pension benefits. It is not disputed since the ruling of the trial court that those, in fact, were vested, and it states as much in the nature of a judicial admission in the petitioner's own trial court pleading.
I thought opposing counsel said that they weren't complaining about the loss of the pension. They were complaining about the loss of the job.
I heard that, Your Honor, and I think that's correct.
Do you think that's fair?
In this case, Your Honor, I think that what we're dealing with is a question that has to be looked at from beyond the consequences as to Mr. McClendon. What is fair is a subjective standard. And as pointed out by the briefs filed by the Friends of the Court, what is being asked here is to replace a rule of law and an objective standard with a subjective one, and to ask the courts of this state to conduct judicial oversight of the actions of every employer in his relationship with his employees. I don't think that you can draw the line here. Counsel for the petitioner has admitted to the court that the duty ought to run both ways. I submit that it's further than that. Not only is the duty going to run both ways, but it cannot be limited to a situation which involves only the discharge or termination of employees. The next step is to supervise the transfer, reassignment, demotion, retraining, relocation of employees, to the point where the courts of the state are going to be requested
to conduct judicial oversight of every type of employment activity that falls in that ambit, because there's no way to circumscribe. What is the result of opening wide the courthouse doors to this kind of litigation? We believe that it results in the closing of the doors of many small businesses, which will be unable to bear the cost associated with that, will be unable to know what standard they're going to be held to by a jury or a court after the fact, by people who cannot deal with the cost of financing this litigation because they're not going to be funded by insurance. That doesn't apply here. So it's not so much a question of fairness, it's fairness to whom. We're dealing with freedoms here, freedoms to act, freedoms to associate, freedom to contract. And the points made earlier in the argument about the duty running the other direction in favor of the employer when a key man or a key woman leaves a position are exactly on point. The facts of this particular case, as I alluded to earlier, are not special enough to justify such a sweeping change. He makes allegations in his petition to the effect that he was uprooted and moved to another city. The facts in the transcript would indicate that that occurred on December 29th of 1979, nearly 2.5 years before he was laid off, and that he was paid $2,636 to accomplish that move. There's evidence in the transcript which suggests that he was laid off because he couldn't make his sales quota in 1981, which he admits was a good year for the company, and he couldn't make his sales quota in 1982, which he admits was a devastating year for the company. When you combine those facts with the problem that there is no place to draw a line and to circumscribe the function of the court in this regard, we believe that the petitioner's position is untenable. And my colleague, the friend of the court, Mr. Pfeiffer, will address some of these policy concerns in his portion of the presentation. As a characteristic of what the courts of this state may face, in view of those facts that I've outlined for you, the petitioner asked in his trial court pleadings for $750,000 in actual damages, $1.5 million in punitive damages, attorney's fees, interest, and court costs. This is in a situation where he was laid off on the 19th of November of 82 with the expectation that he would be employed through the end of that year.
What was the highest annual earnings he ever had? Was that ever included?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe he claims that it was approximately $40,000. What happened to Mr. McClendon is unfortunate, but it happened at the same time to the oil field worker in West Texas, it happened to the engineer in Houston, it happened to the plant worker in the Golden Triangle, it happened to the banker in Dallas, and every other city in the state. It happened to small and medium business people all throughout the state. It happened at a time when banks failed, and savings and loans failed, and bankruptcies increased.
Yeah, but some of these folks have to go to the parachute.
Yes, Your Honor, they did. And I think that goes to another aspect here, is the function of collective bargaining. Parties have the right to negotiate, as was pointed out earlier, with their employer that they cannot be fired except under certain circumstances. That has been the traditional function of organized labor, or of groups that work on behalf of organized labor. Why cannot we allow that particular function to continue? Why must we upset a century of tradition? Why must we do away with an objective standard and the freedom that goes with it and replace it with a subjective standard that will have a profound chilling effect on the activities of employers in the state who are facing difficult times in competing in the marketplace here and in this nation and in this world?
Counsel, what's the relief that's granted under a collective bargaining contract when a person is terminated?
Your Honor,
you seem to be an expert on
that. I'm not an expert in that, Your Honor, and I don't pretend to be. In this case, Mr. McClendon was not a beneficiary of a collective bargaining arrangement. That's why he was terminated.
I'm surprised you learned that the normal recourse that a worker has on a collective bargaining contract is to seek a grievance procedure and proceed to arbitration?
No, Your Honor, it would not.
Well, is that available to this man in this case?
In this case, Your Honor, it was not. We would suggest...
It seems to me your analogy falls in its own way.
Your Honor, if I may address that, the suggestion would be then that this man is without a remedy, and therefore one must be created to deal with the wrong he felt has been done to him. And our position is contrary to that. We believe there is an elaborate system of statutory protections created by the state of Texas and by the United States Congress that would protect him. We believe that he has the availability of the Texas Unemployment Act and the compensation provided thereby.
And what's the maximum benefits he can draw on the Texas Unemployment Compensation Act?
I'm not familiar with the specific amount. However, I will admit that it's a nominal amount.
Do they have the right to put him back to work?
Not in this job, Your Honor.
Do they have the right to grant him retirement benefits?
No, Your Honor.
Do they have the right to award him future wages?
No, Your Honor, they do not. In this case, Mr. McClendon's case is slightly different than that, though, because we are apparently before you today without any dispute or controversy as to whether or not he has any pension benefits. Apparently, Mr. McClendon now accepts the prospect and the probability that he will get pension benefits because he was unable to bring any evidence to show that anyone ever denied him of those benefits or tried to deny him of those benefits. He was able to find additional employment. And in this case, Your Honor, Mr. McClendon's misfortune was different from no one else's who had to go through the difficult times that still affect the people in this state. With the court's permission, as previously granted, I would like to share the balance of the time for the respondent with a friend of the court, Mr. Piper.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. As previously introduced, my name is Bill Pfeiffer. I wish to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to appear as amicus counsel on behalf of the Texas Association of Business. At the outset, I'd like to address three factual scenarios presented by counsel for Mr. McClendon as giving rise to the cry for the adoption of a duty of good faith and fair dealing. The circumstances as they relate to Mr. McClendon and the public policy implications he advances deal with the alleged deprival of pension rights. We have developed in this country since 1935 a very comprehensive scheme for addressing a variety of abuses or potential abuses. And one of those schemes addresses precisely the concern that undermines or underlays the presentation by Mr. McClendon's counsel, and that's the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, Section 510, which makes it illegal to discharge someone for the purpose of depriving them of any benefit to which they're entitled, specifically pension benefits or other benefits within the scope of ERISA.
When was that enacted?
The act was enacted in 1979, as I recall. And in response to a question posed by Justice Mozick, the relief under those circumstances would include reinstatement, future pay, and return of benefits plus back pay.
Are you saying also that is comparable relief to what's available under collective bargaining contract?
Under collective bargaining contract, what we have determined is that in those situations where there is perceived to be an abuse by an employer, an inequality of bargaining, that the employees have been given an opportunity to come together and to equalize that bargaining by sitting down at the negotiating table if they choose to do so. The relief there is reinstatement and back pay. And the reason for that relief, the reason that's been enunciated by Congress, the reason that's been enunciated in numerous court decisions dealing with this wide spectrum of discharge issues, is that the purpose is not to punish. The purpose is to promote employment opportunities and to make the individual whole. That's the entire system that we've developed. That's why this duty of good faith and fair dealing within a tort concept is so inconsistent with what has occurred across this country at both the national and the state level since 1935. The second case that he proposes is that of Mr. Little, who, according to the facts as discussed by counsel for Mr. McClendon, was terminated due to a perception that he had AIDS. There can be no question. Under the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, that is handicap discrimination for which he has an avenue of redress and he has a remedy as set forth by Congress.
There is some question.
In the state of Texas,
the court has held on tuberculosis.
And I don't think that you're going to find very many commentators that raise any serious question as to whether or not AIDS is a handicap. There may be a question as to whether the person who has full-blown AIDS is otherwise qualified, but there can be very, very little question that it is indeed a handicap. But, Your Honor, I suggest that since we have a scheme set up to address that issue, it should be addressed in accordance with and under that statutory scheme that's already been set up to deal with handicap-related issues. The other example that he raised was the individual who protests the unsafe act, who complains of the unsafe act, and is thereupon subjected to termination. That is protected under the Occupational Safety and Health Act, which was passed in the late 1960s, again by Congress. It was passed to protect and advance the cause of employee safety, and it specifically prohibits retaliation against someone who in good faith make complaint or protest unsafe work conditions. We have currently pending in this legislative session a proposal by Senator Parker to include a similar prohibition against retaliation within the state laws. What we have had over the years, since we've dealt with the employment at will doctrine, is a very carefully thought out, developed system, allowing for empirical evaluation of data, analysis through the legislative process, to come up with a system, a program, that balances the rights of the employees and balances the rights of the employer. We have come up with a system that includes a myriad of laws, starting with the National Labor Relations Act, extending to the Fair Labor Standards Act, picking up the Rehabilitation Act, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Polygraph Protection Act of 1988, the Worker Retraining and Notification Act. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on and on. Where there is a genuine basis to question the propriety of action against someone, where it is a genuine concern worthy of rising to the level of adverse litigation impacting so many, many people, it has been addressed by Congress, or it has been addressed by our state legislature. Here in the state of Texas, we have the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act. We have 8307C, which protects retaliation against individuals who have filed workers' compensation claims. We have other legislation within the state protecting individuals who are discharged or otherwise mistreated because of their union membership. The list in this state goes on and on and on. What we are asked here to do today, what you are asked, is to take 50 years of development at both a national and a state level, a very comprehensive scheme involving administrative procedures that take into consideration the need for speed, certainty, a level of stability, that deal with this delicate balance between employee rights and employer rights. What you're being asked to do today is throw it all out. What you're being asked to do today is in the context of a tort duty to tell anyone who believes that they have been improperly terminated to disregard everything else that has occurred and file suit. You've been asked to allow the fact finder, under a vague, uncertain, amorphous standard, to judge the decision of every employer. Today it's being asked to extend the termination. Why wouldn't it apply to promotions, non-promotions, transfers, any form of discipline? How can it work? I submit to you, it absolutely cannot work. We have had this issue addressed by other states. Counsel for Mr. McClendon accurately pointed out, only two states, Montana and Nevada, have adopted a tort-based duty of good faith and fair deal. 37 other states, plus the District of Columbia, have expressly rejected it both as a tort duty and as an implied covenant. In the context of an implied covenant, we have, in this state, as I understand the decisions that have come out from this body, a standard that says an implied covenant can only be found to exist where it is necessary to promote and advance the intent and the fundamental purpose of the parties. Since employment at will
which is a contractual relationship, has as a fundamental intent the right of either side terminated at any time they choose.
Counsel, but here, we're not talking about covenant, we're talking about tort duty. Contractual and tort.
And I concur with you 100%.
Would you address that?
Yes, sir, I will. Tort duties, where they have been found to exist in this state, have been based purely upon a special relationship. The one that's been referred to here is the insured-insurer relationship, and let me run through a few factors why I believe that's totally inapplicable and why it's been rejected in so many other states, most recently California. There is an inequality of bargaining position from the outset in the insured-insurer relationship. Insurance is a virtual necessity for people today. The forms are standardized. The fees are standardized. There is no room for negotiation. That is not true in the employment setting. We have today, contrary to the suggestion by Mr. McClendon's counsel, a very highly mobile workforce with many, many options, a great variance in skill. Many individuals have the strength individually to negotiate. And if they do not, and if there is a concern that supports them pursuing bargaining rights, they have the National Labor Relations Act and the procedure set forth by Congress to address that issue. We have
That's a little bit of an overstatement. You're telling me that one individual has the right to invoke the jurisdiction of the National Labor Relations Board in an intrastate setting?
In an intrastate setting, one individual who is in a position to believe that they are
to invoke the National Labor Relations Act and the required election to be held.
All they have to do is, if they have a problem, get their other employees to join with them.
I'm saying one individual, which is the example you're using.
No, I did not mean to say one individual. You're right, sir.
I didn't think you
were. But one individual has the concern. And if it's a legitimate concern, it will be joined in by others.
We have, in this state, as I understand the decisions that have come out from this body, a standard that says an implied covenant can only be found to exist where it is necessary to promote and advance the intent and the fundamental purpose of the parties. Since employment at will, which is a contractual relationship, has as a fundamental intent the right of either side to terminate it at any time they choose.
Counsel, but here, we're not talking about covenant, we're talking about tort duty. Contractual and tort.
And I concur with you 100%.
Right. Would you address that?
Yes, sir, I will. Tort duties, where they have been found to exist in this state, have been based purely upon a special relationship. The one that's been referred to here is the insured-insurer relationship, and let me run through a few factors why I believe that's totally inapplicable and why it's been rejected in so many other states, most recently California. There is an inequality of bargaining position from the outset in the insured-insurer relationship. Insurance is a virtual necessity for people today. The forms are standardized. The fees are standardized. There is no room for negotiation. That is not true in the employment setting. We have today, contrary to the suggestion by Mr. McClendon's counsel, a very highly mobile workforce with many, many options, a great variance in skills. Many individuals have the strength individually to negotiate. And if they do not, and if there is a concern that supports them pursuing bargaining rights, they have the National Labor Relations Act and the procedure set forth by Congress to address that issue. We have
That's a little bit of an overstatement. You telling me that one individual has the right to invoke the jurisdiction of the National Labor Relations Board in an intrastate setting?
In an intrastate setting, one individual who is in a position to believe that they are
to invoke the National Labor Relations Act and the required election to be held.
All they have to do is, if they have a problem, get their other employees to join with them.
I'm saying one individual, which is the example you're using.
No, I did not mean to say one individual. You're right.
I didn't think you wanted to say that.
But one individual who has the concern, and if it's a legitimate concern, it will be joined in by others. We have a particular problem in the insured-insurer relationship when a loss occurs, because under those circumstances, then the inequality of bargaining is magnified. There is a conflict between the interest of the insurer and the interest of the insured. There is a total inconsistency in what they're seeking to accomplish. In the employment setting, there is no fundamental inconsistency. There is no fundamental conflict. The employer in today's society cannot succeed if they run rampant over the rights of employees. Our economic system does not reward someone who terminates the productive individual, the efficient individual. The system simply doesn't work that way. We don't, in the employment setting, pay in advance against a promise to come. It's a pay-as-you-go setting. You perform your services and you get paid as you go. In the insured-insurer setting, there's no way for the insured individual to mitigate the loss. After the fact, they cannot find other employment. That is not the case in the employment setting. Again, we have a very highly mobile workplace. It is common, indeed a duty, in the situations that we've dealt with for someone to mitigate their damages. There's not only a duty, there's an opportunity to do so, as Mr. McClendon demonstrated within 2.5 months of his layoff. In the insured-insurer relationship, there is not a number of remedies available. They do not exist. That's why you created this duty. That is not true in the context of the employer-employer relationship. The opportunities for relief, for redress, the avenues, the remedies, they're many. And they are put together in a very, very comprehensive scheme. Before I run out of time, let me shift gears and just quickly go down a couple of the policy considerations that have led the other states to reject what you are being asked to consider. It is inconsistent with the concept of mutuality of obligation. That's a fundamental principle in our contract documents, contract rules. It's inconsistent with mobility, which this court most recently addressed in the DeSantis case. Employers need, in a competitive society, in a competitive marketplace that is statewide, nationwide, international, they have to be able to make those decisions. They have to be able to make the myriad of decisions on a day-to-day basis. An economic constraint, a duty constraint that thwarts them, precludes them from doing so, is going to render employers totally incapable of successfully competing. What that will do one of two things. Either put them out of business or force them to locate, relocate, or build their new plants elsewhere, not in the state of Texas. The overwhelming burden that would be imposed upon this court cannot be overstated. I believe the amicus brief from the Texas Employment Law Council contains empirical data showing the increase in employment-related litigation in the states that have adopted either a covenant or a duty is tenfold. Why? Because nobody is going to use the remedial scheme that's already set up.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court, Counsel. I'm Mike Saunders from Houston. I want to address for a minute the arguments that have been made concerning policy before this court, because obviously we're dealing a great deal here with policy. Seems to me, as we address the concerns of companies from out of state building plants here, companies from out of state hiring people here, companies from out of state staying here, we've somehow lost focus of Texas citizens employed by those companies, their rights and their protection. And while there may be all sorts of legislative schemes to protect certain types of employees in certain situations, I dare say that half the employees, especially those non-unionized, don't have the first idea of where to go to get that protection. They don't appeal to a lawyer who wants to take a case where he'll make a fee, and they can't get the protection that those very acts seek to give them. I submit to the court that if there were that good a protection back when the Sabine Pilot and Haupt case was decided, that employee could have gotten his protection from some legislative scheme or from some union or from some federal act or agent, but he couldn't, and he came to the court with a lawyer courageous enough to take that case and appeal to this court in its wisdom to say something all of us knew, that you shouldn't fire somebody because you've asked them to commit an illegal act and they won't do it. And that's not set out anywhere in legislation, and that's not set out anywhere in a scheme. It's just good, sound principle. What we're asking this court to do is to promulgate and enforce good, sound principles based on decisions already made. We're using the insurance avenue, the case that's already been decided, the Arnold case and the Aranda case, but especially the Arnold case, to get to that point. I respectfully differ with Mr. Pfeiffer when he says to this court that there are inherent differences in the situation in insurance cases and in employment cases. Though people might well need insurance for various things and want it and be glad to pay for it, might need the security and protection it affords and might desperately need the benefits it provides when loss occurs, there is nothing to compare with a person's need, man or woman, for good, stable employment to put bread on the table and to get the very insurance benefits that Mr. Pfeiffer says are so important. There is nothing to compare with the unequal bargaining power of an employer who says you come to work at such and such a time, you do this and you do that. There's nothing to compare with that unequal bargaining power, or else most every employee in this state, represented by union or otherwise, would have a nice, sweet employment contract that had good cause in it as a provision. They can't get it, and everybody knows that. There is no way that's going to be written into contracts in this state by employees that have no bargaining power to get it. I submit to the court that what we're asking for is not to punish employers by reams of litigation, lawyers running all over filing cases every time somebody is fired, because I submit to the court that won't happen. There are good employers from this state and otherwise who have employees in this state they will treat fairly, have been treating them fairly for years, and will continue to do so. There are mom-and-pop operations that are going to continue to treat their employees fairly, and we all know it, and juries know it. And a case brought against a mom-and-pop grocery store in some small county in this state where you're saying you treated that young man or young woman unfairly by firing them is not going to get very far, probably. That's what the jury system is about, to evaluate all the facts. The facts are important here, as they were in the Ponsak case in Nevada. That's the Nevada Supreme Court case that promulgated this doctrine of tort recovery for bad faith. There that employee, and I'm sure the court's aware of this, but there that employee, Mr. Ponsak, had been working 10 years for his employer, and his employer wouldn't paint the battery case on his forklift. And so he did what other employees did. He went and got a can of paint that was dented up and no good to anybody out of his employer's stockpile and painted the battery case on his forklift. And when he did that, his employer, because as Mr. Ponsak alleged, he had his pension about to vest in 6 months, his employer said, "Mr. Ponsak, you've stolen paint from the company and you have defaced your forklift. You're fired." Mr. Ponsak said, "Give me a chance to explain." They banned him from the premises. Now, those facts scream out for some relief, and maybe ERISA would have given it to that gentleman, but he went to court and got full relief, tort damages, so that employer wouldn't do that to another employee ever. And it worked, and that court saw the wisdom in what they did, and it was wise. I say to this court, Mr. McClendon, when this issue of pension benefits comes up, it is not an insignificant issue for this reason. When this case was brought, those pension benefits were not vested because they cut him short. Mr. McClendon finds a lawyer, files his case, and suddenly, lo and behold, before the summary judgment proceeding, the employer says, "Oh, there's been a mistake. Pension benefits, why, sure you can have them." Because they knew, I submit to this court, that this, any fact finder and any court that heard this case would be irate that this man had been fired to keep his benefits from vesting. It's outrageous. It's outrageous conduct.
Let me ask you one question.
Yes, sir.
Listening to the scheme of acts that have already been passed, it appears that what they provide for is reinstatement, recovery of attorney's fees, back wages. Okay? But they don't. None of the statutes seem to provide for any sort of tort recovery, and most of the states don't provide for a tort recovery. Why should we extend it to a tort recovery?
Well, Your Honor, I say for the same reasons that we have tort recovery in the Arnold situation, for the same reasons. The unequal bargaining power, the special relationship, it is a tort. You should get tort damages for that. And by that I mean, as in Ponsak, when the court addressed that issue, they said it's not sufficient to give this man his back wages, because the employer will simply calculate what they stand to lose if they're sued. No, we need to give full tort damages. That is, wages, emotional distress. This man lost a house, Mr. Ponczak did. He wouldn't, under the scheme of damages proposed by the defendant in that case, have recovered the loss in that respect. And I say to the court that that's the reason tort damages are often imposed rather than mere contract damages, because they do not, in many situations, give an adequate remedy at law. That's a situation here, I submit to the court. That is not enough to both compensate Mr. McClendon, nor was it Mr. Ponczak, and not enough to deter an employer from outrageous conduct. We are not seeking to impose any penalties or even compensation schemes unnecessarily on employers in this state, employers who employ people in this state, for innocent, good faith, simple mistakes in firing someone. That will not be the standard if the court follows prior law and what we're asking for in our brief. What we're asking for is to put something on paper so that employers of this state know they cannot be mean, low down, malicious, and willful, and arbitrary, and have no good reason, or just make up reasons that have no basis in fact, to fire an employee and ruin his livelihood or her livelihood in this state. That's what we're asking for from this court. And only tort damages can affect that, I submit to the court.
It was earlier stated that the duty would run both ways. And does that mean that if an employer were treating an employee fairly, he would have a duty to remain there for life?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with my partner, Mr. Tavermino, on that point. I'm going to have to scold him about that, but he's a very conservative man and has his own opinion. I'm more outrageously liberal, I suppose. But I would submit to the court that the duty ought to run only one way because of the unequal bargaining position between the employer and the employee, just as is the case in Arnold and the insurance context. So I, fortunately, Mr. Tavermino sitting down, so you can't ask him that question, but I'll advise it in that way. I don't believe it should run both ways. Yes.
What you want us to do is hold there as a duty of good faith and fair dealing. You want to go back and ask the jury to find that your man was fired in order to cut off his pension money.
That and his commission scheme, and to find if those acts are in bad faith. They a jury may believe that those are a good reason to do it. They'll be able to present all the statistics, all of the facts that they have presented to this court, and say, in this context, with the economy the way it is in this state, wasn't it reasonable to fire Perry McClendon? Well, are we really acting in bad faith? And we'll say, yes, they were, and they'll say, no, we weren't. We want a trial on that. But in order to get a trial, we have to have a framework within which to try this case. And that's what I believe an employee in this state is entitled to, his day in court, on that issue. If the court has any other questions, I'll stand up here, but otherwise I believe I'm fine. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take another recess.